this town we call home. Everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
Hello and welcome to episode 60 of Unfunny Nerd Tangent. This is Halloween and we are in a tiny graveyard digging up a pair of spooky classics from the mind of Tim Burton. Beetlejuice, which turned 30 this year, and The Nightmare Before Christmas, which just turned 25. I put on a burlap sack and a pumpkin head for this, but we're going to burn it all down so I can make a second entrance in a pinstriped suit. I'm your host and pumpkin king, Tim Ogney. Joining me in Phoenix, Arizona, he's my right-hand man, and he looks very official in a spider bow tie. Every politician has two faces, but it takes a real leader to stuff them both with spooky snacks. Call a town meeting. It's the mayor of Halloween, Derek Montilla.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Appreciate that. I'd like to take this opportunity to list my qualifications. I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of the Harvard Business School. I travel quite extensively. I lived through the Black Plague and had a pretty good time during that. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see. Not to mention the fact that you're talking to a dead guy. Thank you for having me.
And finally, he's a leading man at the peak of his handsomeness, cast against type as a nerd. Yeah, a staycation with Gina Davis is great, but have you tried collecting miniature models? From the netherworld of Brisbane, it's the Australian Alec Baldwin, Grieg.
Hello. Yes, it is quite funny. Alec Baldwin is doing a series of commercials down here at the moment where he struggles to understand everything about Australia.
That sounds accurate. That sounds like a good commercial for him to be involved with.
Yeah, he's like, what? What's a ute?
I would hope the story is that he finally moved out of America because he got tired of our politics, as he's been threatening to do for decades.
The Trump impression only takes him so far.
Right. Exactly. It's been lucrative for him.
Yeah.
All right, guys, before we get into Beetlejuice and Nightmare Before Christmas, let's just do like a quick throwback to some of Tim Burton's other work he's done. I guess a couple dozen films going all the way back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure in 1985 before he went into Beetlejuice and Batman kind of shortly after that. Greg, I'll start with you. How did you sort of become aware of this guy?
I had seen Beetlejuice and as a kid and just saw, yeah, cool, you know, and it is what it is, and we'll get onto that later. But then when all the Batman stuff began, obviously that was enormous. And all you would hear is, oh, the guy who did Beetlejuice is going to do Batman. And because everybody was concerned, or you would hear things on the radio and people talking and stuff like that. And even as a kid at school, you would hear sort of rumblings of like, oh, it's just going to be like the Adam West show because the guy making the movie did Beetlejuice and he's getting Michael Keaton to be Batman and he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure, so it's going to be a comedy. And then, of course, Batman came out and it wasn't a comedy. It kind of is now when you go back and rewatch it. But at the time, it was like, what the hell is this? So as far as Tim Burton himself, that was kind of my introduction to who he was.
How about you, Derek?
Big Adventure. Not to say that was like my standout Tim Burton, you know, introduction. I would agree like Greg. I think for me, definitely Beetlejuice was that. But I mean, for me, the big first Tim Burton movie in my mind is Edward Scissorhands. But when it goes back to my personal fandom, Pee-wee and The Big Adventure. I love that. I love Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I watched that movie so many times. It was such a weird, you know, now knowing Tim Burton's style and everything, it makes so much sense, but it was such a weird movie at the time. Like, so many things about it were so, like, innocent and wholesome, yet also fucking creepy and weird. You know, you had Large Marge, you had you know, the whole biting people shit. Like, there was all sorts of weird things going on in that fucking movie that were just very different from what you expected. But I think, like, I don't know. I liked Pee-wee a lot before he had his show. I think once that they actually made Pee-wee into an actual, like, kids show, that's really where people lost sight of what his character was. It was kind of a satire thing, you know? But even as a nugget, you know, I kind of understood what it was trying to be, and I loved it. But a lot like Greg, too, Beetlejuice was huge for me. It was another one of the things where, like, I was really into horror movies, but they scared the shit out of me as a kid. So things like Beetlejuice walked the line enough to make me enjoy the horror aspect of it, but not go too deep into it, not go too heavy, and you know, give me nightmares and shit.
Does Beetlejuice kind of
fit? I was like 7 when it came
out. Does it fit into that canon of, like, 1980s had a lot more kind of kid-friendly horror movies? It's like today, like, my kids love the first Goosebumps movie, and I've been meaning to take them to see the second one, because it's like it's not too scary, and it kind of fits in that niche. Like, there was Beetlejuice, there was Gremlins. What else kind of? I guess in the 80s,
I remember, like, Scrooged was kind of. It had its moments. Like, for little kids, there was some stuff where, like, I forget the character's name, but, you know, the guy that comes to him, because it's obviously it's a Christmas carol, you know, so the guy that first comes to him is like, you'll be visited by three ghosts, like, in the yeah. Bill Murray Scrooged one. The guy looks sort of like a zombie, and pits of his eye falls out and this kind of thing. So, like, for little kids, if you're like, let's go watch the guy from Ghostbusters, it'll be funny. that scene where, you know, he pushes him through the window and like his arm snaps off and stuff, and it's like, oh, that's pretty full on for little kids. And then later on, the ghost of Christmas Future is sort of like the big Grim Reaper type thing, so that can be a bit intimidating for little kids. But that, and even the first Ghostbusters movie, I mean, what's that, 1984? Right. That had some shit in it, too. It was a bit
I mean, fuck. Totally. Like, that's what made me think. That's one of the first things I thought of, like, the librarian scene and some of that stuff. But it just walked that line of them keep light enough that you weren't really scared, but you were. Like, I don't know. I've talked about this before, but I loved going to video rental stores as a kid and not actually watching the horror movies, but just going and looking at the VHS boxes that they had on the shelf, because the artwork and the shit that they had out there was creepy and crazy that you got a good idea of what the movie was about just based on that. And that was enough to really creep me out. But going back to what you were saying, Tim, yeah, there was a lot of those movies, I think, like the Monster Squad.
Yeah.
There was a lot of kids' movies that definitely walked the line of having aspects of horror movies and being scary in it. I mean, even Goonies and movies like that, kind of, you know, I don't know how you'd classify them. Today's kids don't really get those same type of movies where they put such a, I don't know, such a creepy, real kind of factor into some of these movies, or like just doing things to make them funny, but also still make them, you know, a little frightening.
Well, like Goonies especially, because it might not have sort of that, like, demonic horror vibe to it, but it does have villains who are just straight up going to murder children. So, it's like, nowadays, like, movies, it's like, oh, we're fine. Like, what are we going to do with the kids? I don't know. Leave them behind. Whereas now, in the Goonies, it was like, no, fucking shoot them. So, but as kids, I don't ever remember being like, disturbed by it. It was just like, oh, they're the bad guys. Like, they need to get away because, there's consequences. Whereas I think that's why Stranger Things hit it so huge as well, because it's kind of the same. Like, it doesn't fuck around either. It's like, no, these things will kill you. It doesn't care if you're 7.
Yeah, I watched Stranger Things with my kids, too. We finished the first season. I think that they're still terrified of Demogorgons.
sure. As they should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they kind of breezed over all of, like, the sex scenes, so I'm okay with that. We didn't have to have any conversations about what were Nancy and Steve doing while Barb was getting eaten. It's like, no.
None of your business. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. That's a moot point. I'll say that's interesting about some of the movies we brought up, including one of the movies we're going to talk about today, Beetlejuice, is that there are original scripts tend to been much different than what the movie product actually ended up being in the 80s. It's interesting to me, especially with iconic movies that had a certain kind of vibe, like Gremlin or Beetlejuice, to find out that the story was, on one hand, much more bland, but also much more violent, much more of a horror movie. Like, Beetlejuice wasn't supposed to be a wise car salesman type, you know? He was supposed to be a... He's supposed to have wings and very demonic, and he was supposed to be like a squatty Middle Eastern man, according to one report about what the original script kind of had him as. And Gremlins was the same thing. You know, there was no Gizmo being the cute, you know, protagonist gremlin character to go along with Billy and keep things going and being adorable. He, in the original script, and ate Billy's fucking dog. So that's some shit that would have drastically changed the tone of these movies. If Beetlejuice was, instead of trying to marry Lydia, had instead wanted to pin her down and rape her, and that had a rape to Beetlejuice, man, I couldn't imagine this movie being as light and whimsical as it ended.
Although in Beetlejuice, if Gina Davis would have just killed that dog in the first place by not swerving with her car, they could have avoided the whole thing.
Oh, that fucking dog!
That dog sucks.
They should have killed that dog before they even saw it on the bridge. They should have ran it over in front of the damn hardware store when they stopped and waved to the old man. Dog.
Yeah, the dog, as it's an amazing scene. Let's just fully like go into Beetlejuice now. As the car is teetering on the precipice of that covered wooden bridge that that should not be something cars are allowed to drive across.
Right.
And the dog is just standing there.
He needed to stay on the fucking plank. All he needed to do was wait until he got the car.
And he knows. You could tell that he knows.
Yeah. That was another thing that was funny to me was the original script had the car accident be much more drastic and violent, including Gina Davis breaking her arm severely. That apparently carried over to the rest of the story. Her arm was just destroyed.
Oh.
And there's a part of me that would have rathered that a little bit, because when I watch that scene to this day, I'm still like, get out of the fucking car. It's like 3 feet of water. You guys didn't even that far, for fuck's sake. Come on. Again, it's part of the tone of the movie. They wanted it to be like, you know, it was supposed to be kind of ridiculous, like a fairy tale would be. I do appreciate in it back versus the movies that we have coming out now that they move this story along so fast.
It is brisk.
And I appreciate that. It doesn't, because it doesn't need more. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need this huge backstory on, you know, how the Maitlands purchased the hardware store and all of that kind of shit. Just keep this shit moving and let's get on to the funny, you know? Let's get on to Michael Keaton with a cowboy hat on doing commercials.
Maybe the dog was secretly possessed by Beetlejuice the whole time.
Oh, whoa. What a reveal. Show that after the credits, and I'm on board with that.
That's in the remake.
The special edition.
Fuck that dog.
He's like, here's the way I can get back. I'll pretend to be this dog and drop these people in 3 feet of water.
Is the official story that they drowned? Is that what we find out later?
Yeah. I did like that. I thought it was clever how you see all the ghosts and everyone in sort of the afterlife kind of remains as they were when they got killed. So like that one guy got, you know, gets run over and he's sliding around on the clothes pegs with the, you know, the tire tracks on him and all that kind of stuff. And the football team that had the car crash and all that. So I thought it was clever that they were like, well, they drowned, so they don't sort of have any like holes in them or anything like that. So if anything, maybe they'd be a bit more, I don't know,
puffy,
like just puffy kinda, in the face and right. Black eyes, or they'd be dripping everywhere or something. But yeah, as far as it's not like they didn't get their head cut off or stabbed 80 times. So they're not sort of got bloody wounds everywhere.
Well, you don't cast that beautiful.
That's a makeup money saver as well, I guess.
You don't cast that beautiful of leads to just screw them up the whole movie, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, they're pretty. Just those Maitlands are so pretty.
They're aggressively pretty people.
See, that's why, we're talking about Batman just before. I think this movie as well is why everyone thought Alec Baldwin was going to be Batman for a while. Because it's like, oh, the guy from Beetlejuice. Yeah, he'll just grab someone from Beetlejuice to be Batman. And it's like,
he sure did.
Yeah, Alec Baldwin. Because right. in the 80s, he looks like Bruce Wayne. Like, so, of course it's going to be him. And then we're like, we hear, oh, no, it's Michael Keaton. Everyone's like, what? Mr. Mom?
Nobody remembers that Alec Baldwin was in Beetlejuice, I don't think. Like, when you bring it up, people do kind of a double take. They're like, wait, who was Alec Baldwin in Beetlejuice? And it's like, oh, he's just the actor with top billing in the movie.
Oh, you know, just the main character, that's all. But he looks like a completely different person from back then. So I can understand people not relating that.
Harvey Dent will be in the movie as well. Oh, well, that's who Alec Baldwin will be. Yeah, he'll be Harvey Dent then. Hang on. Lando? Oh, okay.
Lando.
It's like, nope.
Think again.
Yep. You're getting Mr. Mom and you're getting Lando.
So, it's just so funny thinking of, though, because people hold Michael Keaton in such high regard now as Batman.
Yeah.
And that would have never happened if he would have never been Batman. If he would have never been Beetlejuice. He wasn't supposed to be Beetlejuice. Apparently, Tim Burton originally wanted Sammy Davis Jr. as Beetlejuice.
Wow. Whoa.
Yeah. Sammy Davis Jr. was supposed to be the original Beetlejuice. Because, again, after, like, several script rewrites, it went from kind of being a Middle Eastern man to being, like, African-American man, to being somebody that was kind of like the whole smarmy pack Vegas kind of vibe was the vibe that they were going to go with him, and so they thought Sammy Davis Jr. would be the perfect one.
Plus he could pop his eye out.
Yeah. Oh shit, that would have been funny. I find it interesting though to find like the Beetlejuice character is a little bit like Jason Voorhees, where there was like an ongoing battle over who really owned the rights to it. And when you kind of see the path of the decision making, you can understand where I believe it's David Geffen that's claiming to have like ownership rights over the Beetlejuice character kind of has right, because, you know, it's like people all wanted it to be this thing and then you yourself made it this other thing and that became successful and you did it. You know what I mean? Like, but it's so weird because with scripts, you know, the guy that writes it always kind of gets credit for being the one that writes it, being the creator of all of it, despite the fact that the end product could be totally different from what it was originally meant to be. You know, and Beetlejuice, I feel, is totally that case. This had a total, like, I don't know, stereotypical 80s horror movie vibe to it. And what Tim Burton and other people did, like, after the story was already written and what they did to make it into what it was, completely made it into the, you know, classic memorable movie that we all know it to be. You know, I think otherwise it would have been just another fucking demon possession, crazy haunting the house movie and killing people kind of movie.
Yeah, it would have just been like a shitty knockoff of Fright Night or something like that. Yeah,
right. You know, where he's like this all powerful demon that they summon and he comes around and fucks everything up. Like, it sounds very boring and like I've seen it 1,000 times before, you know. But Beetlejuice itself is, to me, it's a classic. It's different from most movies. It's where I've seen some of my favorite, like Catherine O'Hara for the first time, think of Beetlejuice, you know. And I think of the the dark comedy aspect of it. It really changed, you know, my point of view on how movies could be made and how enjoyable, like, scary stuff could be. Or at least kind of dark stuff.
Mm. Yeah, and having main characters that aren't sort of your, like, white meat baby face either. Like, that sort of, as a kid, you know, like, I remember every sort of main character or the hero and stuff was always sort of like, oh, well, he's an all and out good guy. He wouldn't do anything bad, or he's not sort of selfish or anything like that. Whereas I know, like, Beetlejuice isn't really the main character of this movie, but I mean, it is called Beetlejuice. And going into the movie, I think everybody expected him, it sort of to be more about him than
correct
him being the villain, essentially.
And even that's weird, right? Because that's a real gray area for this movie. I feel like there are several villains at different acts. You know, like people are villainous at different points, but they're all heroic. Like, that's one thing that's really cool about the way that Tim Burton makes films is that you don't necessarily have a definitive hero and villain. I mean, at least in this one, I feel you have definitive heroes in the Maitlands and Lydia. But, like, the villain kind of gets passed around. You know, and even at times where you think, you know, it's the Dietzes and everything else, they come across as just trying to be people, you know, trying to do something special or trying to make their things work. And, you know, the husband seems like a guy that just wants to raise his family in a wholesome, you know, in a wholesome area. The wife seems like somebody that's successful, comes from a big city, that's being unfortunately forced to go live in the middle of fucking nowhere. And, you know, she has all of this shit going for her in the major city, but now she has to go live in wherever, what is it, Winter River, Connecticut. It's, you know, there's like this weird, I don't know, like motivation behind each character, but they're selfish at times, but other times you can kind of understand them being put into this position.
Yeah, because they are sort of...
Beetlejuice is a hero at one point.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it does. It's a really good point. Like, they do sort of switch back and forth because originally, yeah, like you said, the Deets are sort of the villains because it's like, oh, no, they're going to change our house and they've redecorated it to all this awful stuff. And so we'll get Beetlejuice and he'll save the day. And that's kind of where the story leads you, I guess. You do sort of think like, yeah, get him. He'll fix everything. And then it's like, oh, hang on. They've sort of... You can't let him out of the box, kind of thing, because he'll go too far, and then he becomes the villain, and the Deets are sort of or the victims. And when you look at it from their point of view as well, it's like, well, they have moved into the house, and it's like, oh no, they've moved into our house, and they're going to change things and do what they want. It's like, yeah, because it's their house now. Like,
yeah, because you're fucking dead. You're dead, and somebody sold it to them, and they totally have the right to do that to their house, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Know, some of those things that they do are almost criminal, like painting the entire living room in like what looks like a enamel garage flooring.
Yeah, and then it's just the awful statues and things like that, which is quite clever. Of course, they come to life, being a Burton thing.
Right.
He probably has those around his house.
Probably does. You're probably not right about that. I like how what's Delia's, right? That's her name.
Yeah.
Delia.
Catherine O'Hara. Yeah.
I like how she gets trapped not but twice during the movie by the same statue. That was a nice little you know move. It's so fucking weird and bizarre, but you know, watch especially now, you know, this many years later after it came out. So much of it holds up, right? Like, so much of it is still really solid filmmaking, despite the fact that its special effects are so dated. Like, yeah, when they walk outside, go to the moon of Saturn and the sandworms and shit, it's not the best. That part doesn't really hold up super well, but a lot of it really does, and it just goes to show how like creative and innovative Tim Burton was with making the special effects in this movie and making it the way that he did, you know. I really love everything about fucking Beetlejuice. I've always have, even when I was a little kid. I never thought of Beetlejuice as being a bad guy because everything he said and did was so funny and entertaining. And I watched it with my 7-year-old daughter and I could tell she was the exact same way. He's like, outside of the snake scene, he is an amazing, funny character for both adults and kids alike. You know, you get the kids' Looney Tunes style humor that kids can appreciate, and then you also get him doing the jerk off motion when they ask him if he can be scary. It's like a well rounded character that really just delivers for young and old.
Yeah, I love that as well. We're like, all right, I'll see you later. Nice fucking model. Honk, honk.
Like, yes. Yeah. Like, it's like you almost get outright like raunchy he was at times, because the movie itself is like a lot of Tim Burton movies, despite it being super dark, it's still really wholesome. it's still, there's something about it that when you're watching it, it's like A Nightmare Before Christmas. It totally feels like a movie, despite the fact that it's really fucking dark and weird, you know? But I think that's the reason why it works so well for so many of us when we were kids, you know?
I mean, look at all those fairy tales. Like, they all became Disney movies, and they all sort of got the super sweet treatment. But all of those old Grimm brothers fairy tales and stuff, like, they're all dark as fuck. And yeah, it's, you know, like Little Mermaid and all that
Little
stuff.
Mermaid commits suicide. Oh. Yeah, like, that shit's wild. Yeah, I have that book in pop-up form. My daughter has it, and we just read that part of the book. We don't read the last, like, two pages of that. But, yeah, right. I mean, it gets the super sweet, you know, fairy tale makeover ending. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that it's... Like, I'll give you a perfect comparison. Universal Studios used to have a Beetlejuice stage show, right? And it was some shit like Beetlejuice rock and roll graveyard fucking experience shit, right? And I would go to Universal Studios quite a bit as a kid because my dad was a general manager of a hotel in the Woodland Hills area. It was near Universal. I'd go out for my summers, didn't have shit to do. My dad in the 90s. Fucking car with a driver from the hotel and send my ass off to Universal Studios. So I was like 9 years old spending a day by myself at Universal Studios, which wasn't the worst thing. But back then they didn't have a lot of rides. It was just all these stage shows and shit, right? So I remember I had the Beetlejuice rock and roll thing added on, and I went to it like one time and never went to it again because Beetlejuice to me was an amazing character, and there was all sorts of fucking stage shows that were based on actual movies and television shows. There was the Miami Vice stage show, there was the Conan, the Barbarian thing. There was all sorts of shows like as a kid. Those all rock. They were awesome. They had all sorts of awesome special effects and shit. This fucking stage show had Beetlejuice singing songs with Frankenstein and Dracula and shit. And I remember even as a 9-year-old kid being like, fuck this shit. I am too old for this bullshit. I'll be out at Fievel's Playland playing over there. Because that's the way I fucking felt. Even at that point, Beetlejuice had established a certain type of adult humor for me, even as a kid. I think growing up in the 80s, we all kind of understand this concept of like, we watch shit that was way inappropriate at a young age. That's just the way stuff happened. I mean, comedies and stuff we watched as a family usually had, you know, a lot of fuck in it and other sexual content, all sorts of shit that kids shouldn't be seeing. That was just the well-rounded family movies were made when we were kids. But, like, it was crazy to me to think back, especially when I was watching it now as an adult, how, like, as a kid, I fully rejected this idea of Beetlejuice being like this slapstick cartoon character. I had heard that guy curse too many times to believe that he's now doing a rock and roll stage show with Frankenstein and Dracula and shit. Like, I was so against this concept. I think that is really an honor to the way that they made this movie, the way they developed this particular character. Like, it would be just to fall into whatever people wanted me to believe he was, especially considering that they made a cartoon of Beetlejuice during this period of time when I was a kid, you know?
He translated well into this cartoon, like unlike the stage show where they try to shoehorn him in with a bunch of bogus cartoon monsters. The cartoon like
Universal
was
monster Beetlejuice, you know? Like, yeah, the cartoon was good. I liked it.
I don't really remember much of it. I know I just bought Beetlejuice on iTunes, though, and he came with, like, three episodes of the cartoon.
It was like the adventures of Beetlejuice and Lydia, essentially, as well.
Yeah, Lydia was able to join him in the Netherworld and go on different kinds of adventures, and Beetlejuice, like, would wear a lot of different hats
Sure.
I think he was always trying to get romantic, and Lydia was always kind of not quite having it. Like, was...
Right.
A little bit of a will there, won't they, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, in a cartoony way, in a Pepe Le Pew kind of rapey way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to get you one of these days, whether you like it or not, right. That kind of way.
Which is, yeah. I guess that's maybe one part of the Beetlejuice character that doesn't hold up quite as well, like him just trying to, like, look up Gina Davis's skirt with a stick or something like that.
I mean, yes and no. It's, like, well, he's a scumbag. Like, yeah. I thought that translated really well still to this day. It even just exists even more so that he's a scumbag. Like, back then it was like, oh, I get that behavior. Nowadays it's like, oh, yeah, he's a fucking piece of shit.
And like, those really are the stakes of the movie. Like, understanding what a scumbag he is. We can only, like, imagine what's going to happen when he marries Lydia and gets a free pass to run amok in the real world.
Now, yeah, my daughter pointed something interesting out to me that I hadn't even noticed about Beetlejuice, which I've, like, that part is so fucking amazing. My 7-year-old daughter watching it one time can be like, hey, I noticed this, and me being like, oh, yeah. She was like, there's a lot of threes in this movie. And I was like, what? She's like, yeah, you know, it's like that family is three people. You have to knock 3 times on that door to get the door to open. And you have to say Juice's name 3 times. And she said a couple of other things. And I was like, holy shit, yeah. Never noticed that before. Huh.
Hmm.
Maybe that's some sort of theme of this movie. I don't know. Way to fucking be way smarter than me, 7-year-old. Thing I created.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I never thought of that. Oh yeah, but that's a good observation.
Good observation. Like, she was holding the cover. She was holding the movie, and it had the three of them on the, like, the Maitlands and Beetlejuice on the cover. That old movie poster and stuff. Like, I was like, wow, that's awesome. Very, very astute. You
know? I'm looking at the credits right now, and someone's credited as 3-fingered typist.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it's even more than you think.
Holy shit! It goes deeper than I even thought.
Right?
Did you? Did you guys ever watch? Just while we're on the three thing, did you guys ever watch Community?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever see the Beetlejuice joke that they did in that? Where it took them 3 seasons to do it, but in season 1 and season 2, someone mentions Beetlejuice, and then in season 3, in their Halloween episode, where everyone's in costume, someone says Beetlejuice and he walks past in the background. So on the third time saying Beetlejuice, he walks past.
Oh my God.
And because it's a Halloween episode, everyone's in costume, you don't sort of think like, what the fuck? Yeah. Like, it's just, there's a guy in
Beetlejuice. Right. Like, why is there a guy in Beetlejuice back there? Yeah, yeah, that's.
So you watch it again, it's like season 1, season 2, and then season 3. It's like Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. And then there he is. He just strolls past. It's amazing.
Did you bring that up? And one of the things I think of is the fact that I saw, like, a BuzzFeed article that basically said Jack Skellington debuted in Beetlejuice, which is correct. The first ever appearance of Jack Skellington is in Beetlejuice, atop Beetlejuice's hat when he comes out as the carnival ride at the end of the movie after Lydia says his name 3 times and he does the attention Kmart shoppers bit. There's a Jack Skellington head on top of his carousel headpiece that he's wearing, along with a number of other, like, characters that look like they would fit right in the Nightmare Before Christmas universe. I think a couple of them might have even snuck in there. Just weird fucking alien demonic looking shit around his headpiece. And so that was really interesting to me. Like, it's not surprising, though. Like, it's not surprising that people see it as some big giant reveal, and I'm like, no, just that guy's style going over from one movie to the next.
Yeah.
Oh,
he likes black and white stripes.
Right. I'm going to use that same drawing that I drew of that skull on top of Beetlejuice's head as the main character for this movie. Like, that's it. I did find it interesting that Disney has been sneaking Skellington skulls in movies like Finding Nemo and such. That was interesting to me.
Has become his own kind of hidden Mickey.
He has. They use him in any kind of scene where there's something like sinister going on, something devilish, and they'll try to hide him. Like in Finding Nemo, he's like a bubble in like the aquarium, you know, that kind of thing. But Disney loves that shit. Disney loves that shit. That's the only one. The fact that Disney loves doing stuff like that so much is the one thing that makes me think that they're going to figure out a way to Pixar theory a reality and somehow connect all
movies together. Oh, man. I'm pretty on board with that. I think there's a lot to that. It's just a matter of filling in a few gaps. But yeah,
It's really not. It's something they've been doing in their Disney movies since the fucking 90s. Like Aladdin had Beauty and the Beast in it at one point, all sorts of other shit. Like this has been something they've been doing, but someone's just smart enough to figure out a way to connect it all together within the Pixar universe. And I'm with you though. I dig it. I dig anything like that because I feel like it. Anything that adds to the mythology, anything that adds to the whole story makes it better. I think that's one of the reasons why the whole Beetlejuice story is so good. I've often said, like, the best movies and stories are the ones where you kind of walk into it midway in. And in a way, what happens with the Maitlands is that they walk into this situation midway in. Right, like in a way, the story kind of explains why ghosts get stuck in a house for a fucking number of years. Why? Well, because they don't read the manual. That's why they got stuck. They didn't read the handbook for the recently deceased, and they don't know what the fuck to do next. And they're a bunch of schlubs. If they would have read the manual, have been known what to do next. You know,
like if the movie was made today, there'd be a 5 to 10 minute like prologue before it where we see Beetlejuice as a human being getting killed back in, you know, 1642 or something, and then it would be 700 years later or whatever the story is, you know. And
he's all talking shit like he's Bugs Bunny. He goes down, and then they burn him at the stake or some shit. Like, not interested at all in seeing that, you know. Like, that's what makes this interesting. We never find out exactly, like, what Beetlejuice is, what the fucking curse is that's on Beetlejuice that requires him to say his name 3 times. And you know what? I never want to know the information. Like, it's amazing because as a person watching a movie like that, it makes the movie better. Then I think it, from a writer aspect, it makes it so much easier to write a movie like that because you don't really have to think about that. You're like, nope, that's just what happens. That's it.
Yeah. If anything, I think people, you would just assume that he has the curse on him and he can only be summoned and he's kind of locked away because of he's pulled this shit before. And someone with more like, magic powers than the Maitlands has done something about it. So they've sort of like, released him from his prison.
You gotta have a way to have a safety on you at all, and that's what it was.
One thing I never noticed originally in Beetlejuice, they say that the people who are the public servants, the people who have to like help the other dead people through the afterlife, are people who have committed suicide. Right. And we get that in a couple of different. There's a couple of different mentions of it, and but also the what's their caseworker's name?
Juno or something.
Juno, the smoking lady. Who's, and that's a cool effect too, when the smoke just like billows out of her neck, but it's like nothing. she's great, and she says that Beetlejuice used to work with her. Or that
your apprentice,
right? So it could be that he killed himself, but then somehow got out of work
dig deep enough, I suppose. But like Derek said, like it's just okay. He's this horrible thing, but he's got such a con man sort of personality, and he's charming and things like that, and he can do things that people that you need him to do.
Yeah.
So he sort of fools people into I'll fix it. Oh, no problem. Just let me out, and then oh shit, you know, now we're in trouble. So
yeah. Once he's free, he does whatever the fuck he wants, and then he apologizes for it later, and then he does it again. You know, or whatever the case may be. Like, it doesn't really matter. It really doesn't.
But it does seem like the answers are there. You do get the idea that they've like in a very tight like 90-minute runtime, they've done a lot of netherworld building.
Oh man, I loved the netherworld so much as a kid. How much work that they put into like, you know, the shrunken head guy and the girl cut in half, and you know, you were saying, like I thought I was super smart when I caught a line about people that commit suicide have to become you know, public servants in the afterlife, and that the girl that was the clerk or the secretary was, you know, slitting her wrists, you know. That was subtle, and it was done in such a way that, like, it almost makes me miss, you know, storytelling done this way.
Mm, a bit of subtlety goes a long way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, that was really subtle when you think about it. They make a joke about it later in the movie, like, after that girl, like, now they would have made sure that that joke happened beforehand, you know, or whatever. Yeah. But it's kind of interesting because it's like finding out this other stuff about the movie that they didn't like or that they wanted to change, or, you know, the tone that they wanted to set, how violent they wanted it to be. They didn't even want it fucking called Beetlejuice. Like, Tim Burton had to fight and refuse to call it anything other than Beetlejuice. So much so that he, like, suggested a bullshit name just as a joke. And the studio was like, oh, yeah, we should name it that. It was like called, he was like, scared sheetless, like that, based on the scene where they're the sheet. And the studio was like, yeah, that's way better than Beetlejuice. He's like, fuck you, we're not Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
I've never heard that before. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, they wanted to call all sorts of, like, just gassed up. And it's funny because when you think about it, how much would that have changed the, like, the mythology and the legend? This movie, like, that would have been so substantial. Just like it would have been substantial, I think, if they want, like, you know, choice was to call Beetlejuice the way that they spell it in the movie, Beetlejuice. Like, no one would have been able to that fucking hit in a million years. No one would have known what that movie was called at all. So
it's a star, I think. Beetlejuice is a star in the night sky, and it's spelled that way. But the fact that it is named Beetlejuice and spelled the way it is, like, that, it just about tells you everything you need to know about the movie going in. You know, this is going to be weird.
Yeah. No, that's accurate, and it is weird, awesome, and it's just super unique. There's something, watch it, especially now. It kind of goes to say that about Burton movies. I long for movie this original and different. And just weird. I miss the time where movies were made and they weren't based on a book or an existing property character. I miss the times when movies were made where there wasn't an entire franchise or whatever around it to ruin that shit. You know, it's kind of crazy because in researching this movie, I found out that they were going to do a sequel to it called Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Oh, no.
Could you imagine if they released Beetlejuice Goes Fucking Hawaiian in 1990? I can't even imagine.
Yeah. So that was one of the movies that, and here's the Kevin Smith reference for the show. that was one of the movies that he got offered when Warner Brothers were starting to deal with him. They said, you know, we've got this Beetlejuice movie, Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. And I remember on one of the Kevin Smith Nights with Kevin Smith or something, one of those DVDs, he was like, you know, I think we said all we needed to say with the first Beetlejuice. Like, I don't think you need to do another one. And then, of course, they said to him, oh, and we've got this Superman thing. And so, of course, Kevin Smith was like, oh, I'll have a go at Superman, please. But, yeah, so even, like, in what, 96 or 97, they were still, like, 10 years later, they were still trying to do this shitty fucking Hawaiian Beetlejuice. Like, fuck.
Hey,
like,
of all things, like, spoiler, a sequel probably would be bad. Spoiler alert, as far as 2011, still trying to do the Beetlejuice sequel. And then when they asked the dude that was tied to it back in 2011, a year ago, if it was still happening, he said yes. So it's like, oh my God, they're never going to let him down. But now, could you imagine them doing a Beetlejuice sequel now? Like, oh my God, there's a part that thinks that, like, retro sequels year after the first one took place are kind of working, that this wouldn't be so bad. As long as they deal with the Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, it wouldn't be so bad. Like, I wouldn't mind seeing a Beetlejuice movie with a grown, you know, Winona Ryder and fat Alec Baldwin and a Gina Davis who's still a G smoking looking, like, let's call these people back.
Jeffrey Jones. No, not Jeffrey Jones.
No, he's dead.
He died.
He's dead, and Catherine O'Hara now remarried, and her new husband is Eugene Levy, of course.
Oh, no, yes. Yeah, they were meant to be together.
Yeah. And the new boss of the underworld is Gilbert Godfrey.
Yes! 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 Book, film, I want to see.
Do you guys think Beetlejuice is like the most Michael Keaton character? Like he just, I don't know why when I think of Michael Keaton, I think of Beetlejuice. Like Michael Keaton wants you to remember him as Batman, I think. Yes. He's making this effort. He'll say, I'm Batman as many times as it takes, but I feel like Beetlejuice is just so Michael Keaton.
You're right, because it's like characters that happened after Beetlejuice and to come from Beetlejuice. You know, the line in Batman where he fucking, you know, where you go, we want to get nuts, let's get nuts. That was fucking Beetlejuice.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, his voice in Birdman, you know how when he hears the voice in his head and he's like, hey, we should have gone to, we should have done the sequel and all this kind of shit. It's fucking Beetlejuice. Like, the Birdman voice is Beetlejuice.
Well, he was in that Kenneth Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing. Which was like, you know, this star-studded, you know, Shakespeare play done for the big screen, and his character in that is basically Beetlejuice.
And even have you guys seen Multiplicity, where Michael Keaton has like all the clones of himself?
I know what you're talking about. I never did see it. I always wanted to.
No, it's pretty good. Anyway, the clones. The longer their clones, the sort of the different experiences, the further their personalities kind of drift away from the original. So one guy is he's cloned and he's in charge of the house. So does all the domestic stuff and cooking and cleaning and all that kind of stuff. And so he kind of becomes a bit campy and a bit sort of feminine. And the guy that does all the work, so he does all the construction work and things like that, he becomes like real butch and kind of a heavy drinker, and he starts smoking again and stuff like that. And like, he's sort of borderline Beetlejuice as well, because he's, you know, he has that sort of personality and the deeper voice and sort of stuff like that. So yeah, I think most things, like you said, after Beetlejuice that Keaton has done, there's definite sort of hints towards it.
and when Michael Keaton dies, I think he'll just become Beetlejuice. He will get all those powers for himself. But well, somebody will have to say his name three times.
It reminds me of Depp after doing Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Mm. You know, now every character he does weird is basically just Hunter S. Thompson as a fictional character. You know, and you hear it and you see it in him, and like, I think playing a character like that, especially after you spent so many years playing normal characters, really just, I mean, in one aspect, kind of Keaton, it allows you to find that weird, crazy side of you and that weird voice. But then everything you do after that that's weird and crazy is going to have definitely a picture, a side of that character in it, you know? It's hard to get away from it at that point because you do so many crazy, weird fucking voices. As a person, you know.
Yeah. I think Johnny Depp, especially once he did the Pirates movies as well, it's like, oh, he's Captain Jack Sparrow as a vampire. He's Captain Jack Sparrow as a detective. It's sort of the almost
right. And see, know. Me personally, what I see is Hunter S. Thompson as a pirate, as this, because it's the hand motions, that was all from his time with Thompson. You know, he hung out with him for like 6 months or however long, and he fucking like started acting like him. And I mean, it worked well for Captain Jack Sparrow because he weird, quirky character, right? So like, it was the perfect inspiration to draw for that. But at the same time, like you said, yeah, now that you just see that in everything he does now.
Mm. Yeah, it's a shtick now, almost.
I don't think Jack Sparrow is that much like Hunter Thompson. I get the hand motions, but the voice is very different and.
Is a precursor though, like Derek said, like
there's a lot of them in there, but yeah of course, because it's a fucking pirate, Tim. It's not gonna be acting like a fucking drug sports writer that went around Vegas doing mescaline. It's gonna be slightly different.
Sure. All right, guys.
All we need is Captain Jack Sparrow in Backcountry. And then
yes!
you can picture exactly how he would move his hands, actually, like driving.
Yeah. We can't stop here. Fucking bad country. that would be cool.
All right, so Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah, Nightmare the Before Christmas.
This podcast.
Five years later, they've taken the thing from the top of Beetlejuice's little circus tent, and they've put it. He gets his own movie and becomes an instant icon, I guess, because Tim Burton had been working on this idea for a very long time by going to growing up in California and seeing these stores where there's no real change in season, but they got Halloween stuff and Christmas stuff right next to each other. I mean, people freak out about this every year, that the Christmas stuff and the Halloween, the Christmas music starts in October, and the pumpkin beers come out in August. It's ridiculous. And so from, I don't think they had pumpkin beers as much back then, but from this idea came this quirky idea Tim Burton had to have these Halloween characters take over Christmas. And he wanted to make this as a TV special, and spent years, I guess, pitching this to different TV networks, and nobody wanted to buy it. Nobody wanted to pay for it. And finally he got Disney to do it, but they wouldn't even do it as a Disney movie. They had to do it separately as a Touchstone Pictures imprint. And they even came back to him. I was just reading about this. Came back to him with notes like we want Jack Skellington to have eyes. We think he looks too much like a monster. He needs to have eyes.
Oh, God.
Which would have just been terrible.
I just love the fact that he's you want him to have eyes? Nope.
Yeah. Yeah, they wouldn't have budget.
How many blinks? We'll just make him blink. How about that?
We'll make him blink. That's the best we can fucking do.
Yeah. Well, one thing Burton did compromise on
is his eyes. Yeah.
He had him originally in an all-black suit, and I guess Henry Selick, the director, had to change the suit to pinstripes because you couldn't really see Jack against the black backgrounds that they were filming.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why comic books, people's back in the 60s and all that, everyone's hair is blue.
Yeah.
With lots of white shine on it and stuff, because you can't see anything. And Batman, that's why he had the gray suit as well. That's why, everyone's like, oh, he's gray. He doesn't wear fully black in the comics. It's because you wouldn't see him.
Yeah. He'd just be a smudge.
Yeah.
Right.
It took us all the way until Ben Affleck to get the gray Batman suit in a movie, at least. So, and look how that turned out.
I love the suit. I love that suit.
Don't get Tim going.
Yeah. At least Adam West had he didn't need all that stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Well, his suit was also gray. It was both blue and gray.
Yeah,
it was very much
pure West.
Yep.
Now, one thing I always thought about this movie is, it had a certain level of popularity with your alternative crowd. Right, so this type of people that some consider emo or goth or whatever used to be really into this movie when I was growing up. I remember watching this movie and enjoying it and being that was a movie, and then going on with my life like you would with most movies. But for some kids in my school, this movie became a way of life. It became a consistent everything in their lives. And I think the only reason why that is because I think there are kids like me, like myself, that just watched the movies, got the messages and whatever. And I think there's that, that same type of crowd that might have listened to heavy metal a little earlier or whatever the fuck, whatever they got into that made them different and feel separated from society. And I feel like Nightmare Before Christmas became this weird fairy tale specifically for them that they just embraced as like the dark side, but still just like any kid, they still wanted to watch a fairy tale animated feature. They were just too dark to enjoy some shit like Little Mermaid at the time, or the Rescuers Down Under, so they needed something like Nightmare Before Christmas.
Nice pull.
Right.
Hey.
Shout out to Australia.
The shit out of Rescuers Down Under.
That was
see the titties.
That was good.
We're talking about hidden pictures and stuff. Have you seen the titties in Rescuers?
Oh, I've seen titties in Rescuers.
Yeah.
You know I've seen titties in Rescuers.
I got meant to Google this when the show's over.
I was not. I mean, like, it say I wasn't into it. But for me as a kid, Nightmare Before Christmas had way too many songs and was way too much of a musical thing. Like, so it was so amazing. Like, some of the darker, cooler kids at my school, or whatever you would call them, like fucking goth, whatever, like, were so into it. It was like, really, that musical movie where they sing the whole fucking time?
And the songs are weird. They're not like any kind of pop song. They're not like something that they could have played on the radio at the time or really ever.
It's a musical song. It's like a Broadway musical type song, right?
Mm. Right.
What's this?
You
know, like,
well, that's what I noticed because, well, this is the part of the podcast where I have to mention that this movie is much like Tim with Die Hard. This is, I only just watched this movie for the first time this week. So it was, came out. Yeah. When we were discussing what we could do for the show for a Halloween thing, like I said to Tim, well, Beetlejuice is 30 years old. And then Tim said, well, what about Nightmare Before Christmas? Like, that's having its 25th anniversary as well, and Tim Burton sort of stuff, and that could be cool. And I'm like, I've never actually seen it, so let's do it. So I'm coming to this from sort of like brand new, basically.
Oh, man, that's fascinating. I just never... So what are your thoughts on it? Like, I want to hear your thoughts on watching it for the first time.
Well, I was aware of it when it came out because it came out when I was about 14, so it's like, oh, yeah, there's that movie. And I don't ever remember being like, oh, fuck that. I'm not going to watch that. Like, that's for kids or that's stupid. Like, I just never, never got to it. And then I would hear all the time, like, people say, oh, Nightmare Before Christmas. I'd be like, yeah, I've never seen it. And then just never got around to it. So, but about 5 minutes in, I thought, oh, hang on, this seems familiar. Maybe I have seen this because I was like, Let me look up the synopsis. And I'm like, okay, it was basically like this creepy guy named Jack, and he's trying to steal like steal sort of the premise from these other people and you know, make it his own. And I'm like, oh, I think I have seen this. I've seen this. I know it's Jack Skellington. Maybe I have seen it. And then I went back and I'm like, no, I haven't seen it. But watching it, it was pretty awesome. Like, the songs, like you said, I'm not a big musical guy, but the songs are really well done, like, because they're so weird. And just the whole backing of, like, the concept that, like, oh, we're sort of sick of Halloween, let's steal Christmas, like, and make it our own. Like, that's really cool. And being that there are these creepy Halloween characters as well, like, yeah. I wouldn't rave about it, but because obviously I'm probably too old now to sort of had it hit me the right way, but yeah, I was surprised at the sort of the technical marvels of it, I think, more than anything.
Sure. Yeah, it's a beautifully done claymation movie. I think a lot of the stuff they do is really impressive, and again, just kind of like Beetlejuice, so much of it because of the way that they did, the quality that they did into it, holds up to this day. There's not a lot of it where you watch you're like, oh man, this is really dated, like some of those old Christmas specials, you know, the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and things like that. But that's what Tim Burton intended for this to be, a modern day dark Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you know. And I dug it. I dug the story. I dug the concept of Jack Skellington wanting more, because it's kind of like what I'm saying. You have Halloween out there, have the decorations out. We don't even get to Halloween Day. Yeah. And they're already putting Christmas shit out on top of the Halloween decorations.
Is it the same in Australia?
Well, we never had much of a Halloween thing probably up until about 15, 20 years ago. Now it's sort of full swing. Like, you know, when I was a kid, it was all still, you would hear about Halloween and that would quickly sort of get shot down. Like, you know, that's not us. That's an American holiday. We don't do that here. Not for any sort of reason other than just, well, we don't do it. Like, it wasn't like, oh, it's not Thanksgiving where like you guys have a reason for doing Thanksgiving, whereas us, it's like it would just be a copy. Yeah. So Halloween is its own thing in a sense. So, but now it is probably, you know, I had kids coming around to the house last year wanting a trick or treat, and it's like, oh, I don't have anything for you because it's we don't do it. Kids,
Greg, what the most fuck? Kids don't do anything for the kids.
Yeah,
but like, it hasn't got to that level yet where, okay, off we go. Like everyone's trick or treating. Like it's sort of slowly filtering in. But in the shops, everything is Halloween.
You go get candy and no kids come treat it. You guess what? You get to keep the candy.
Yeah, it's kind of a win-win.
It's a win-win situation, my man. Go get yourself some candy. But yeah, you know, I mean, Halloween has been the less important holiday of the two, despite the fact that you get stuff on both and both are fun for kids. Like, you can't compare Thanksgiving to Halloween or Christmas because Thanksgiving, you just sit down with your family and eat food. Yeah. This is different, you know?
At least Thanksgiving, you guys have like a historical context as to why it's a thing, whereas Halloween is just like, we just like spooky shit.
Hallows Eve.
Yeah, but it's
something that we never even did here in the United States, but it's totally ours now, you know. Yeah.
But Halloween's it, right? Halloween is like, can we call that our second biggest holiday? Like, we don't get the day off of work, but like, we do spend basically a whole month celebrating it, just like Christmas. You know, October
is the biggest holiday because it's the most fun, I think. Like, everything else is very religious or patriotic or whatever. This is different, man. This is like completely imaginary, made up bullshit. This is like the professional wrestling version of a holiday. Everybody knows it's fake. Everybody knows it's bullshit. We all just get to be in on it and dress in ridiculous costumes and enjoy the fuck out of it. That's what Halloween is, you know? I've always loved Halloween.
And even in spite of that, The Nightmare Before Christmas is to me very much a Christmas movie. It's not a Halloween movie. Like it starts like at the very end of Halloween, and they've wrapped up Halloween. They've all come home, and now like that's when the kind of like holiday doldrums set in for Jack, and he wants to do something different. He wants something more, and the other monsters they don't understand. They don't get it at all. Mm. They just want to scare kids.
You need anything more?
They're very, very good at their jobs, but also very myopic people. And that's just kind of that's who they are. And it's not even until the very end that they kind of get like what Christmas was all about, when like Santa brings them some snow.
I did think it was a bit odd, like right from the start, they're kind of like, oh, Jack's the Pumpkin King, but you never sort of really see him do anything as the Pumpkin King. Like he doesn't, I don't know, maybe I missed it, but he doesn't sort of. He's sort of their go-to guy for Halloween, obviously, like the mayor and all the, you know, the townsfolk sort of look up to him like, oh, Jack will fix it. Jack's the guy to do the Halloween stuff. But they sort of reference him as the Pumpkin King a few times. And it's like, oh, I thought there might have, I don't know, there was something coming, like he was going to, I don't know. Like at the end where he's, not to skip ahead, but when he's fighting, what's his name, Oogie Boogie or whatever, I thought, oh, here we go now. It's going to be like, I don't know, he'll be throwing pumpkins, or it'll be something. He's going to morph into
pumpkin king.
Something. I don't know.
He's the Pumpkin King because he's the king of Halloween. That's what makes him the Pumpkin King.
Well, he can walk
the Halloween King.
He can go to the pumpkin patch and he can walk down that ramp and he can like sing songs by himself and no one else can do that.
Yeah, that's true.
But, well, maybe Sally can do that. But there's a couple of reasons why Sally and Jack are the only ones for each other. And one is that like all of Jack's other groupies are like half his height, and he's not into that. You could see that early on in the movie when all the witches are like, "Oh, Jack."
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I did like the when it started, I thought, "Oh, okay, now this Sally thing with the weird like mad scientist," and I'm like, all right, well, this is a bit strange. It kicked along and she was having visions and stuff like, oh, you shouldn't do Christmas, stick to Halloween.
Like, yeah, and her relationship with Dr. Finkelstein is also pretty weird. Like, I think that's what
Sally doesn't put out.
Yeah, and he's kind of mad about that, but I think
he's frustrated, Tim.
He's frustrated. He's frustrated, but he's holding on to hope, and that's the reason why he tolerates being poisoned as much as he does, I think. Like he's not happy about the frequent poisonings.
I thought she killed him at the start.
it's called Deadly Nightshade, and she keeps giving it to him.
Yeah, I thought, oh, she's killed him to escape. And then it was like, oh, you poisoned me again. I'm like, oh, all right, this is a regular thing.
Yeah. But it seems like these characters can die. Is that like, it's not all the way clear, because they're also like these magical creatures that sort of live outside of time. But it looks like, you know, Jack is maybe in some real peril when they're trying to shoot him out of the sky with howitzers. And I think we could agree that Oogie Boogie definitely gets killed, right?
Yeah.
Most of the bugs fall into the boiling pot, and that very last one scurries away, and Santa just like puts his boot down on it, crunches that thing. Yeah. Santa flexes so hard at the end of that scene. He's
really does not really like, have done anything. Of course, Santa.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Santa. Santa like was having a rough go of it, but then right at the end there, he's like, "Of course, I can fix Christmas, Jack."
Yeah. I like that. Yeah, he just doesn't have time.
Santa Claus, bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. If anyone
flex this fucking beard muscle, bitch, bam.
If anyone should have been voiced by Michael Keaton, it was Santa Claus.
Oh yeah,
the Beetlejuice voice. That would have been great.
I would have been totally on board with that.
And one of the sad things about Nightmare Before Christmas is that Patrick Stewart was originally the guy who read the that kind of opening bit, the opening narration about the different holidays and where they come from.
Really? Oh, that would have been awesome.
That was cut from the movie and replaced with the guy who did the voice of Santa Claus, just, I think, because it had to be shorter or something. But it, I guess you can still
too many Star Trek references.
Right.
It's like, you know, and Jack will be going when no one has gone before. And they're like, no, cut. That's your other show, Patrick.
Starlog 488, Jack Skellington.
And that was, geez, 93. Was that right in the middle of like peak TNG?
Yep.
Yeah.
TNG finished in 94. So.
Wow.
Yep. He would have been, in full Picard mode at that point. Gearing up for the movies.
Another missed opportunity by them to just have him be in it anyway.
Yeah, he could have just, I don't know.
Yeah. Or he could have been at the end. He could have also been Santa. He would have been all right.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
That's
what's his name? What did you say his name was? Finkelstein.
Oh,
that
would
have been funny. Just because he, you know. Patrick Stewart seems to like playing against type, like when he does his voices for American Dad and stuff like that. So,
oh God, yes,
yeah.
You know, he'd be like, "Oh, good, I don't have to be proper. Excellent, I can just say silly things." Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely. I noticed like the more the movie went on, it sort of. I was surprised because I always thought that Tim Burton directed it too. And it was only at the end where it came up with the other guy's name. And I'm like, oh, hang on. Like, obviously it's a Tim Burton thing. Like, it's sort of all his idea and concept and character design and all that. But I, for some reason, I'd always thought that he had actually directed it as well. But he did everything but. But, I mean, it's like I said before, it's easily the most Tim Burton thing ever just because it's... Every character, like the Sally, sort of looks like the Corpse Bride character from that movie when that came out and stuff. Yeah. So
he actually did direct Corpse Bride.
Yeah, that's probably why, because I did see that, and I that's probably why I thought as well that he must have done this. But
Henry Selick who kind of took this ball and ran with it because he's been directing these cool stop motion movies ever since, and he's now over at. This company called Leica, where they've made, you know, Coraline and Kubo and the Two Strings and you know, continue to make these stop motion movies that are really pushing the limit of what they can do. Interestingly, that studio is owned by Nike owner Phil Knight, and it's in Portland, which just seems unlikely and weird to me, but I guess, you know, Steve Jobs owned Pixar at one point, so that's...
Well, with I'll just ask Derek as well. You were saying before about Beetlejuice, how like you missed the fact that it was just, here's a movie. It's not a comic book. It's not a It's not a book. It's not a play or anything like that. We're not planning 7 movies over 5 years or whatever it is, franchise stuff. This movie obviously is like all the stop motion stuff. There is some other animation sort of spliced in here and there. Like you can tell like smoke and certain ghosts that float into the sky and stuff like that's the old 2D animation sort of drawn over the top. But like we watching this, I noticed a lot of it just being, it's completely different having the old stop motion stuff than the CGI stuff now. So do you prefer this sort of style or are you more like, oh no, I like the CGI that is meant to look like stop motion?
No, I mean, don't get me wrong. I prefer modern special effects. Like the stop motion isn't really, it still shows its age. I think that there's just, it's kind of like using puppets. Like back when, you know, a lot of the science fiction fantasy movies used to use more people in suits and Muppet. When I rewatch those movies, those special effects hold up. They still look good. Those Muppet characters in Labyrinth and other movies like that still look like of quality. You know, and that's one thing that's really important about what they did. You know, when I was talking about Beetlejuice earlier, any time that they were on Saturn or they stepped outside the house, it looked awful, especially in modern day high definition on my flat screen TV with all the fucking upgrades and everything Blu-ray I was watching had. It really made it look terrible. It really showed its age. But so many other things in the movie didn't, because it just used good old-fashioned, you know, special effects, which were, you know, Muppets and things falling out of the ceiling and makeup and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, like the shrimp bowl trick where they get their hands, their faces pushed back. That looks so good, you know, even to this day, because it only, you know, they really had shrimp sitting out there in a way where the shrimp looked like a fucking hand before it happened, but it was really just shrimp. And they had a really well-done fucking, you know, prosthetic glove hand thing, whatever you want to call it, that they put on the puppeteers to make it was a shrimp hand. It was an awesome scene. Again, that particular scene still looked fucking great. So, I mean, yeah, I guess to a degree, I'm okay with the old school special effects, but motion stuff, you know, definitely shows its age.
I disagree so much, dude. I'm watching like the Blu-ray version of Nightmare Before Christmas, which I think is like the best we've got available right now.
Well,
upscaled onto a 4K TV, and oh, I mean, the artistry on display when you can see like the textures of the fabrics and you can see like every little line in the clay.
Sure, but let me finish what I was going to say.
Sure.
Can I finish what I was going to say?
I guess.
I was going to say the stop motion effects in fucking Beetlejuice look dated because of the fact that they're used against the normal, you know, whatever. So, like, the stop motion effects of Beetlejuice as the snake and shit don't look great. But the stop motion effects in Nightmare Before Christmas do look great because there's nothing to like compare it to. So that particular world is itself. There's nothing that like makes you kind of feel like you're watching something different. Whereas some of the special effects of Beetlejuice are, you know, it's a little bit more difficult because of them being, you know, against regular actors on a movie, and they just look flat and they don't look like they're there, right? But like Tim was saying, the artistry in Nightmare Before Christmas looks is different, and so it holds up way better than the special effects in Beetlejuice because it's its own world, and everybody stop animation or stop motion animation in it, so nothing there makes you feel like it's outside of that world. Okay, Tim, now you go ahead and gush about the animation effects again.
I think even in the 5 years between between Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands, or Beetlejuice and Nightmare Before Christmas, they made some huge jumps in what they were able to do with stop motion. Because I think that, like, it's not what they did in Nightmare Before Christmas is not like the old, you know, claymation Christmas specials either. Like, this is a level of attention to detail never before seen in stop motion. And these are the guys who've been pushing the boundaries ever since. I think, you know, you compare Kubo and the Two Strings side by side with like any Pixar movie, and it's going to be a whole different thing, you know. And that's not, and Pixar is, I mean, you look at like Coco and the incredible things they've done with the graphics there. It's gotten to the point too where there's things like the Lego Movie that have taken the look of stop motion animation and replicated it in CGI to the point where it just about looks like you're looking at a miniature model the whole time. Even with all that, like this stop motion can hold its own, and the Nightmare Before Christmas it's still great. It's still almost perfect.
But yeah, I think it works, like Derek said, because you only see the stop motion for the whole time. Your brain doesn't sort of flicker back and forth between real people and then the animation and stuff like that. So it doesn't sort of, it's not jarring. So
it always looked weird. As a kid, it would really freak me out to see like the Star Wars monsters, you know, where you've got this very cool looking miniature being filmed in stop motion against a blue screen or whatever, you know, whatever the, they used blue and green screens, I think, on Star Wars. But it wasn't, the green screens today are so much more seamless than they used to be that now, like, you can't always tell when you're on a green screen versus, you know, back then you'd sort of see that edge.
Yeah, well, like the Tauntaun and stuff in Empire, like, never looked great.
Right.
Even as a kid, I'd watch that and be like, oh, yeah, it's sort of,
yeah.
It's like
Clash of the fucking Titans, man.
Oh, yeah.
But
and that's the big deal with Jurassic Park as well. Like, that whole movie would have been something completely different if they had to use the stop motion effects. So,
but they did, and that movie holds up really well. But I don't know. I love Nightmare Before Christmas. I love its quirkiness. I love its weird fairy tale aspect to it, despite the fact that it's so fucking dark and kind of not right. one of my favorite things is the fact that, you know, Disney eventually fully released it, and, you know, I remember it was a slow go, but eventually they fully embraced it, and they have all sorts of merchandise for it in the theme park now, and they do the Haunted Mansion with this Nightmare Before Christmas layover during the holidays, and it's very cool. It's very cool because, like I believe it was Tim said earlier, there was one time Disney didn't want to be associated with this film at all.
Yeah. And you can understand let's do why, it but yeah.
Subsidiary. Well, I can and I can't, because it's not like this isn't a wholesome film. Right? I mean, when you watch this, is it not a wholesome fucking kid story at its core? I still find it to
be. It is if you watch it. Yeah. But you can, like, Disney, the executives aren't going to sit down and watch it before making a decision. And that's their problem, is it's like they look at it and go, oh, it's got ghosts and zombies and vampires and stuff. And they kidnap Santa Claus, and he's the hero. What?
Jack Skellington is just kind of this, like, you know, aloof guy with, like, rich people problems who decides to imperil a bunch of people because he's bored at work, you know? So in that respect, like, like, you don't really get the sense that Jack learns anything. Like, he makes it better, but it's like, I think that
I guess he just sort of gives up at the end. Like, it didn't work. They shot me down with fucking cannons.
But I think the big character turn for him is that he finally sees Sally. You know, she can become part of his life and hopefully be a positive influence the next time he gets a really bad idea.
Yeah, it's like Teen Wolf. You know, the girl of your dreams was there the whole time, Scott. So stop playing basketball and just, you know. But again, off you go.
Derek touched on this a little bit earlier, though.
Wait, I just want to touch on something before we move on. One thing that I would like to say is that despite you saying that Disney always had like this weird thing to highlight, you know, kind of like the creepiness of things. Like when I was a kid, I remember there was this Disney Halloween special, and it was like a 90-minute television special, which was like hosted by like the villains and shit. It was like Magic Mirror was the host.
Is that the one with the Headless Horseman cartoon?
Yeah. I mean, I think it had the skeleton dance in it and all that stuff. It was essentially like a greatest of their creepy, you know, specials all put into one as a Halloween kind of special,
that,
right?
That apart from Fantasia. They always
right.
show that.
Yeah. Right. But it's like, again, it highlighted that Disney never had a problem with being around like creepy, scary stuff. Like you said, the Headless Horseman, Fantasia, all of that stuff. That's why it's just so weird to me that they do pick and choose, and that there's all of these, like, you know, R-related decisions that go into it, but then retroactively, based on the success of something, they're totally okay with being like, yeah, no, this is ours. We did this. This was ours. Yeah. I know said earlier that we didn't, but this was ours.
Well, this came out in 93, which is only a year after the whole Batman Returns Happy Meal thing as well. So
Tim Burton was dangerous. They're like the National Parents Council or whatever, you know, all the church ladies had their eye on Tim Burton. He was a bad guy at that point.
What happened with the Happy Meal scandal?
Well, they had Happy Meals with toys based around Batman Returns with Penguin and all that. And of course you watch that movie and Penguin's very like perverted and kind of
dark as fuck.
Yeah.
Dark yeah. It's
fuck, to say
yeah. The and the plot revolves around killing the kids at the end of it and all that kind of stuff. So, and then it's like, hey, kids, make sure you get your fucking Big Mac cheeseburger Happy Meal. Like, all the toys came with it. So, I think it was sort of marketed as a little kids movie because it's Batman and McDonald's Happy Meals. And of course, kids were freaking out a bit.
Of course, it was a darker tone.
Christopher Walken.
First, also a Christmas movie, by the way, Batman Returns, along with Nightmare Before Christmas and Die Hard,
and Gremlins.
And Gremlins, yeah, we're covering an awful lot of Christmas movies. We're gonna have to like retweet this when it's Christmas time. this episode, but like they should have. I mean, it does go into a little darker territory, I guess, and definitely like bloodier, more violent territory than the first Batman movie.
Yeah,
there's some substantial gore when the Penguin makes his final appearance. And
well, the first four Batman movies, this sort of might be a way to bring it sort of all the way back around. But like those first four movies, it's like the studio gives one to a director and they were like, yeah, we're happy with that. Went really well, positive reviews, made lots of money, make the next one and do what you like. And that's sort of what happened. And they did the same thing twice because they had the first movie with Jack Nicholson and all that and Tim Burton. And they're like, yeah, it was a huge hit. Batman was everywhere. It was this massive, you know, financial like windfall for studios and all that. And then it was like, all right, well, what do you want to do with the second one, Tim? Okay, do whatever you want. And then you get Batman Returns, which is sort of the super Burton version of the first movie. And then they do the same thing with Schumacher. And it was like, all right, we went a different way and we got Batman Forever and it's a bit lighter and campier and we got Jim Carrey and all that, but it made tons of money and everyone was happy with it. Great. What do you want to do for the next one? Just do what you like. And it's just Schumacher overboard and you get fucking Batman and Robin. So it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. But I was thinking about this too and wondering like how much Tim Burton has sort of contributed to the struggles that Warner Brothers is having today, where you just take your franchise and give it over to a single auteur and kind of let him do what he wants. Cause you know, so much of the, you know, bad feeling about the DC movies now can be attributed to Zack Snyder, you know, love him or hate him. And,
no, it's because they sucked him. Because the DC movie fucking sucked. That's why.
Yeah, but why?
But what I'm
why
saying is
they suck because DC doesn't care and they're selfish and they don't care and they just want what Marvel has, but they don't want to look out and be patient and have a decent groundwork. Wonder Woman, wonderful film. Why
have more Wonder Woman.
What I'm saying is what Marvel did, there's
a DC movie not in the hands of Zack Snyder, and it came out pretty well.
But no, but Zack Snyder, he wrote the story for the movie. He executive produced it. He had a lot to. He cast or was like oversaw the casting of Gal Gadot in the first place. Like he had a lot to do with Wonder Woman. But what I'm trying to say is what Marvel has done in the MCU is they've taken the auteur out of it quite a bit. Like there's, you know, so many of the decisions that Tim Burton was making are now being made by Kevin Feige or by like the studio as a whole, like Jon Favreau does not put his stamp on the first Iron Man, you know. The closest that we've gotten to that is James Gunn with Guardians of the Galaxy, who has since been fired for reasons I don't even want to talk about. But
Taika Waititi kind of brought his style.
Yeah, and Taika Waititi a little bit, but they've been they've been operating within the confines of this established universe that they did by kind of having, you know, several directors who were willing to just play ball with the studio's vision. Whereas with the DC universe, like they kind of like Zack Snyder made Man of Steel, and they were like, "Hey, we want to do the shared universe. Why don't you make the vision? Why don't you tell us what the Justice League is?"
Just laziness.
Yeah.
Well, what would you guys think if for some reason the planets aligned and they gave Tim Burton like another go at a Batman movie? What would you think of that? Would it have to be Michael Keaton again? Do you think, or would you be happy for him to sort of create something new?
Well, this is kind of bringing it all back around. Like we were talking about how refreshing it was to have movies like Beetlejuice, like, Pee-wee's Big Adventure was an adaptation of the Pee-wee Herman stage show, I guess, but really a fresh new thing. And then Nightmare Before Christmas, which is like nothing else. If you look at the stuff Tim Burton's done lately, like the next movie he's got coming out is the live action Dumbo, which like, I mean that trailer, you know, I'm not going to pretend like it doesn't tug at my heartstrings, but there's not a whole lot going on that's like, you know, a brand new idea. You know, like he did Alice in Wonderland, he did Dark Shadows, he did Frankenweenie, which is like an adaptation of a short film that he had made a long time before. I didn't see Big Eyes, but that one was kind of based on a true story.
I guess Sweeney Todd was based on, you know, obviously the stage show musical.
Right, adaptation of a musical.
Ed Wood was about a guy who already existed, I suppose. Miss Peregrine's school for whatever is just fucking X-Men.
Like, right. And you've got Corpse Bride, I guess, which that wasn't like an original idea of Tim Burton's, but that was kind of a cool, fresh thing. But even before that, like, I mean, he did Sleepy Hollow, Planet of the Apes.
Terrible. Yeah.
Sleepy Hollow, I thought, was all right. And then Mars Attacks. Mars Attacks is kind of a classic. That could be its own show for us.
I hate that fucking movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate Mars Attacks. I just, fuck it. Everything about it. I was so geared up for it, and I watched it, and I'm like, this is fucking dog shit.
Yeah, but really, since this period that we're talking about, Tim Burton hasn't done a whole lot of, like work that was, like, out of his own head.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, he does definitely put his own spin on stuff, though. So, I mean, I guess he's not completely, just a hired gun. Like, if you hire him to make your movie, I mean, like Alice in Wonderland, like, they're definitely Tim Burton movies, but it's still kind of Alice in Wonderland, in a sense. But he does have he's sort of restrained stylistic choices in those ones, but, I mean, they're still very Tim Burton. But yeah, those Beetlejuice. I think Beetlejuice, and now that I've seen Nightmare Before Christmas, Beetlejuice and that, and maybe Batman Returns. I think they're probably him at his most Tim Burton-ness.
Yeah,
and maybe Pee Wee as well.
Yeah,
and Pee Wee's such a different like tone of stuff. So yeah,
I would maybe even throw Mars Attacks in there, but that's its own. That's so goofball compared to his normal.
I guess a bit. Like yeah. Yeah, because I guess it kind of goes in weird, dark places too. But
And I guess my other
Wallace
question.
Not a fan.
That I don't want to. I don't want to wrap up without circling back to it. Derek touched on how popular Nightmare Before Christmas was with like a certain group of kids. It was like these like almost goth kids, probably kids who got into Marilyn Manson like later on in school. Is that fair, Derek?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's totally and stuff.
Yeah, and I mean,
maybe even like less mainstream than Marilyn Manson, like Lamb and, you know, other shit. Like I don't know. They like it definitely is. It slowly became one of those things that, like, it's weird, but it was like a connection between me and other like fucking weird goth kids. I knew lines from that movie, and they loved the movie, and I'd see some shit from it, and it was like, oh, hey, we have something in common. We both like that movie. You know what I mean? But it was like, it was so weird to me at the time that the particular group of kids that I went to junior high school with and high school with, like, gravitated toward that movie the way they did.
And like, Sally became a go-to kind of hot Halloween costume for girls who like to read Neil Gaiman. And
just describing my wife.
Has she dressed up as Sally before?
No, but she likes Neil Gaiman and she loves this movie. That's why I was able to see it like that, because it was just, it's in the DVD collection. So it was my wife. So I just went and grabbed it and watched it. So she loves it, but she's like, yeah, into Tool and
You guys have a couple's costume now. This Halloween. How did this sort of
skinny enough, that's, Jack.
It's so weird to me that you've never watched it. Like, it's legit. Hey, that's a good costume. It's so legitimately weird to me that you haven't seen this film before. Because I think for you personally, I would have thought you would have watched it just out of the, like we touched on earlier, the technical aspects of it. It really was a, like, as far as claymation goes or whatever, it was, you know, one of the best movies ever made as far as claymation goes.
It is very, I can understand people, like, when they hear, like, you've never seen it? Like, you, of all people, like, the goofy guy who's seen fucking everything, but yeah, I just missed it. I don't know what it was. Yeah.
How do we go from this sort of stereotype we have about the people who like Nightmare Before Christmas to this enduring thing where there has always been merchandise made for 25 years? You've always been able to go buy Nightmare Before Christmas Christmas tree ornaments or shirts or figurines, and it's become this thing that Disney has embraced. And every year, like, Danny Elfman does a thing at the Hollywood Bowl, or I think now it might be at like the Nokia Theater or something like that.
It's at the Hollywood Bowl. I attended it, actually. Spectacular.
I am jealous.
One of the greatest things we've ever done. I mean, it was Danny Elfman. He did the whole thing with the music from the film, with the film playing there. Catherine O'Hara, everybody was there. All the voices were actually there.
That's
something
cool.
That's weird to me, because we're here in Phoenix, Arizona, right? So we don't think of something like that being that easy for those people to come and do, considering that they probably live within a couple of miles of the Hollywood Bowl. But that's what happens in LA. You can literally have all the original voices come do the voices, and had like an Oingo Boingo reunion at the end of the show where they play, shit. Like, it was great. It was such an amazing night. My wife and I love Nightmare Before Christmas so much. It's one of our things, you know, it's the things that brought us together. My wife and I are just Disney fanatics as a whole. We have lanyard, fuck shit ton of pins on them. We've gone to Disney so many times we can't even remember. My daughter's 7 years old, and I think she's gone to Disney parks like 6 times. Like, basically almost every year she's been alive, she's gone to Disney park just about.
That's cool.
We love Disney, but we also are kind of alternative people, and we're those kind of people that appreciate, like, the Nightmare Before Christmas stuff, the merch, the way that it makes you feel kind of cool while buying Disney stuff. You know, I think that's the thing that's always the appeal to it. It's like the punk side of Disney, you know, is the Nightmare Before Christmas. Not only the story itself, because the story itself at its core is still a love story and a musical and a fairy. So it's fucking, it's all in like the rap of the rapping being like this punk, you know, fucking kind of facade. It's still a Disney movie at its core. And
thing about it is it allows people that don't want to, you know, go around claiming Cinderella and Prince Charming to be like, yeah, nah, we're definitely.
And maybe that's what it is. Is it Disney has realized that it can kind of, you know, polish up Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, bring it back into the mainstream Disney canon, and with it can take some of these people who are on the fringe and really bring them back into the Disney thrall.
Well, it's kind of like they can have cake and eat it too. You know, it's kind of like the ridiculousness of Disney being like, we're not going to serve alcohol in Disneyland or Disney World, but we will serve it in all of our parks. Oh, and by the way, when we add the new Star Wars land to both of those parks, since there'll be a cantina, we'll serve alcohol in the cantina, so you go there, drink actual adult alcohol in Disneyland. But you can't eat a cantina with alcohol. We don't want you walking around regular Disneyland with alcohol.
Sorry.
Like, what in the actual fuck?
Also, really? No droids. No droids in the cantina, I've heard.
Yeah, no droids can leave the area and directly into the cantina. Rules. Mostly, it's that same type of shit of having Night Before Christmas out under the Touchstone banner originally. It's that same type of weird, like, I'm giving you a rule, and then you kind of looking around going, you know nobody cares about this. You know nobody gets... Fuck. You know every other theme park allows you to buy much beer and alcohol as you want to while you're there. You know that I shit yesterday at California Adventure and I puked on the Cars ride. Nobody said me.
That was you?
That was me. But for some reason I can only get rum in my fucking, you know, my dip at Animal Kingdom. And now that I know how good rum is, Dole Whip, I can never back to just eat a normal Dole Whip. I can just go to Adventure and to get a Dole Whip without dark rum in it. I'm ruined now knowing how delicious it is with dark rum in it. It's the same kind of thing. It has these weird rules that they live by. Nobody gives a shit out anymore. It's antiquated. It's something from the 50s. Like, oh, serve alcohol in our park. Well, that's not a positive.
Yeah,
telling me that is only a negative for me not to go to your park. It's not something that makes me feel like you're super wholesome or all about kids. It's absurd at the point.
But they've already
I'm just angry.
They've already got their hooks in, Derek. That's what's up. Like once they realize the ways they can make more money off you, they're gonna pivot. They're gonna figure it out. I think, or they'll just
alcohol.
Or Warner Brothers will just release a new Beetlejuice movie where he's in Hawaii with Frankenstein. Dracula.
That is
like a crossover.
Yep.
We are going to get a Beetlejuice sequel before we die. All of us.
Well, let's get Beetlejuice and Jack Skellington in a movie together.
Like they
can still be live action, and just Jack can be like this little little angel demon on his shoulder going, "Come on, let's go."
I would to see Jack be the one that restores his head to full size.
There you go.
Oh yeah, that's
they could live in the model together in the Maitland's model. They just party on with Sally and the weird
pops out of
the hat. Scientist.
Pops out of the hat. Yeah.
it's a Halloween miracle.
Yep. All right, guys.
Watch this movie if you haven't seen them. They're fun.
Yes. That's going to do it for us over here at the Unfunny Nerd Tangent. Follow us all on Twitter. Get Greg at GregT13. Derek at Cap_Caveman with a K. I'm at Tim Ogney. Make sure you follow the show at Unfunny Nerd Tangent and check out UnfunnyNerdTangent.com, where every week Greg is coming at us with the 40 for 40 series. Greg, what's coming up this week?
Well, now that I've seen it, no.
Hey, late ad.
For Christmas is number 15.
Yeah. No, we're on to number 18 at the moment, which is Taxi Driver. So much like I had never seen this Nightmare Before Christmas, if you've never seen Taxi Driver, go out and watch it because, yeah.
I've never seen Taxi Driver. Excellent movie. I'll do it. I owe you.
Get on that, Tim, because, I read all your Saga comic books and...
We podcasted for hours Saga.
It's all true.
Get on the Taxi Driver and watch it. It still really holds up. It really does. If you just, you could slightly alter some of the technology and things like that. Like obviously people would have cell phones and the cars would be different and stuff like that. But yeah, it's, I think if that came out today, it would still be pretty relevant. So, which is a pretty scary thing to think about. But yeah, Taxi Driver, number 18.
And of course, all roads lead back to thesteelcage.com, where you can check out thesteelcageshop.com and get our t-shirt, Mon Milfma. And of course, should we just make the same offer as last year if we get any sexy Mon Milfmas for Halloween? Yep, nobody did it last year. maybe this year somebody will dress up for us.
Yep.
All right.
Mon Milfma Sally crossover. It's going to happen.
Oh, man. Wow.
Now you make it so.
Yeah.
There's your Patrick Stewart again.
Yeah. Just lit the show on fire.
Yep.
All right. That's the end of Unfunny Nerd Tangent 60. And remember, kids, that is why I don't do two podcasts a night anymore, babe. I won't do.
Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body liner. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work your body liner. Work, 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 Sinora, work it all the time. My girl's name is Sonora, I tell you friends I adore her. And when she dances, oh brother, she's a hurricane in all kinds of weather. Jump in the line, rock your body on time.